From west to east and kingdom to kingdom, you're listening to the Connecting with Walt podcast. Connecting with Walt is brought to you by Dreams Unlimited Travel, experts at helping you plan the perfect Disney vacation. The best way to support the show is by booking a Disneyland, Walt Disney World, Disney Cruise Line, or Adventures by Disney vacation with Dreams Unlimited Travel. Get a free no-obligation quote today for your next dream vacation at dreamsunlimitedtravel.com. Hey there, hi there, ho there, and welcome to episode 288 of Connecting with Walt. I am your host and Diz historian, Michael Bowling. I am joined by my co-host, executive producer, and good friend, Craig Williams. Craig, how are you today?
I am doing fantastic. Can I just coin a new word or phrase?
A new word. I like that. I'm surprised with all the innovative things they've done with Fantasia. They didn't somehow use that word.
You know, maybe that's how they got the name for Fantasia. Was through fantastic. Who knows? We'll never know unless we already covered that on this episode.
About Fantasmic?
Yeah.
I think on one of the Disneyland shows we talked about when we were doing the 60 years of Disneyland and we talked about Fantasmic, I think we talked about how they came up with that name.
Hmm. Well, so, we'll have to go back to it one day.
I know, because I don't remember. So, anyway, well, we're making our final pitch this week for the Q&A show. So do you want to give the cutoff date and all the rules and regulations? And
yes, you have. Well, depending on when you listen to this, you have 1 week left to get in your final questions. We are cutting off questions on April 5th. And as always, you can leave those questions for us over at facebook.com/DizUnlimited. At the pinned post that's at the top of the page, just drop your question in the comment section there. And if you don't have Facebook or it's just too much of a struggle, we said too, you can always tweet at us at Connecting Walt on Twitter or X, whatever you would like to call it. And we will take emails too, if it's easier for you to do that way. Michael Bowling, MichaelBowling at DisneyInfo.com, or Craig at DisneyInfo.com, CRAIG at DisneyInfo.com. Not Craig with an E. CRAIG at DisneyInfo.com. And those are the best ways to get us your questions. And just a reminder, please make sure that the questions don't ask us what we think Walt would think of this or that. We don't have those answers, so we won't answer those questions. And also, along those same lines, try to think of a question that's not just answered in a simple yes or no question form or yes or no answer form. Let us get a little conversation going with it. So get us those questions before April 5th, and you'll see those episodes pop up right as we're going into our first hiatus of 2025. Mm-hmm. Whoa, 2024. What year do I think it is?
So eating too many of those peeps for Easter.
I don't know what reality I'm living in. I just stopped calling it 2023, and now I'm jumping to next year already.
No, that's fine. I just put the last of the Christmas decorations back in a storage unit this week. So
you'll have to dig them out in another week.
I know, really, in order to be ready by Christmas. The good thing is, at least I saw how the new cats, Walt and Roy, react to a Christmas tree. Because the undecorated Christmas tree was still up. And that was the last thing I had to take down. And it was artificial. It's not like I had a dead tree up. They ignored it pretty much. So I thought, okay, good. That means next year or this year, I can put up the tree with the expensive Disney decorations.
There you go.
Because every year I've had a new cat, and I never know how they're going to react to the tree. So I thought, okay, now I can put it, which is – I could put up the Disney tree, which is way more time consuming, but hopefully I'll have the time to do it now. So
yes, anyway. Hopefully.
Well, as Craig was talking about earlier, we've been talking about Fantasia in our last three episodes. We've been talking about the history of Walt Disney's Fantasia and the planning that went into the various selections. So this week, we conclude our exploration of the film, starting with the last selection, which is a combination of Night on Bald Mountain and Ave Maria. And these are completely different in mood and were meant to illustrate the struggle between the profane and sacred. The first piece is Night on Bald Mountain by Modeste Mussorgsky. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing his name terribly. The second is Ave Maria by Franz Schubert. With the ending of the first piece blending smoothly into the second, so the bells announcing the morning in Night on Bald Mountain seem to be calling the faithful to worship in Ave Maria. So Mussorgsky first wrote Night on Bald Mountain for solo piano and orchestra in 1860, then rewrote it in 1868, 1871, and then again in 1875. And it's one of the first tone poems by a Russian composer. Now, this piece was never performed during the composer's lifetime. In 1882, Mussorgsky's friend Rimsky-Korsakov revised and reorchestrated the piece and conducted its first performance in 1886. And it was this arrangement that Stokowski recorded for Fantasia in 1939. Now, Mussorgsky's tone poem was not published in its original form until 1968. When Erwin Kostel conducted the digital re-recording of the Fantasia soundtrack in 1982, and he used Mussorgsky's own more savage orchestration. I think I have said that poor composer's name differently every single time.
I actually don't think I've ever said his name out loud either, so I can't really help you.
I don't think this. I've ever said it out loud. And some of his music is some of my favorite, like Pictures at an Exhibition, that I just heard performed live a few weeks ago, and Night on Bald Mountain, some of my favorite pieces. I don't think I've ever said his name.
Yep. I've just never had a reason to say his name. And, you know, luckily you're doing all the hard work today. And so I will continue my streak of not having to say it.
Now, Bald Mountain is said to be Mount Triglav near Slovenia. I think Deems Taylor wrote it was near Kiev. According to Russian mythology, evil spirits gather on Walpurgis night, which is similar to our Halloween, but it's in June, to worship the devil. At this witch's Sabbath, Chernobog, the god of evil and death, appears at the top of Bald Mountain and gathers together all the evil entities, witches, demons, vampires, and skeletons of the dead not buried in consecrated ground. They all dance furiously as Chernobog condemns them by the handful to the fiery pit inside the mountain. He also finds wicked pleasure in transforming some of these demons into animals before throwing them into the flames. As he reaches out for more evil companions, the morning church bells drive the spirits and demons back to their graveyards and a cowering Chernobog back into the mountain. These same bells that cause Chernobog to retreat into a mountaintop also call the faithful to worship the god of love. The German lyrics for Schubert's songs were translated from Sir Walter Scott's The Lady of the Lake. The English text was written especially for Fantasia by Rachel Field. A procession of figures carrying candles is faintly seen through the fog. As they cross the bridge, their lights reflect on the water below. As they ascend the hill, Gothic trees forms emerge out of the fog, suggesting the sanctuary of a church. The procession passes along the edge of a quiet lake, and in the distance we see a pulsating light that slowly takes a form suggesting the window of a cathedral. The camera pans through the window into a sunrise. A sunburst then fills the sky, and the choir sings the last chords of Ave Maria. All of Walt Disney's best work has been an allegorical representation of the triumph of life and hope over the powers of despair and death, starting with the first time Mickey Mouse encountered Peg Leg Pete in Steamboat Willie, to death personified as the Wicked Witch in Snow White, the hunters in Bambi. Despair is depicted in the scenes with Monstro the Whale in Pinocchio and the Elephant Cage in Dumbo. But none of these had the force of Chernabog, the god of evil in Slavonic mythology. Walt Disney once said, "To captivate our varied and worldwide audience of all ages, the nature and treatment of the fairy tale, the legend, the myth have to be elementally simple. Good and evil, the antagonists of all great drama in some guise, must be believably personalized. The moral ideas common to all humanity must be upheld." It was Bill Tytla's animation of Chernabog that made the god of evil the personification of evil in this segment. It is still considered one of the high points in the art of animation. Tytla had animated the Seven Dwarfs, most memorably Grumpy. He also animated Stromboli and Pinocchio, and the giant in The Brave Little Tailor. It was Walt Disney who chose him to animate Chernabog.
Yeah, and I feel like you can see a lot of, in Stromboli in particular, that menacing look that he has on his face. You can see that also come through Chernabog in another level. But to me, like, you know, there is something about Stromboli that always has been and always will be terrifying. So a great choice to use Tytla for that, just because he knew what he was doing.
Oh, yeah. And the animation of Stromboli always fascinates me in Pinocchio. Just all his movements and his features, you know, his facial features.
Yeah.
And everything. I mean, Tytla just had him down. Yeah. And he communicates just, you know, that sort of the evil intent that he had for Pinocchio just came through in his features, in the way he spoke, in his movements. There was nothing kind about that character.
Yeah, I think he does a great job with his animating, you know, taking out the factor of sound. You could watch it as a silent movie, or just watch the images of it, and you know the intentions of the characters, and you can see right through them just by the animation and the movements and the facial structures. And to me, that's a sign of a fantastic animator.
I was just thinking that when you said that I think that can be said of a lot of the animators during this era they communicated everything so well through the movements and the facial features. I don't know if that can be said today. I don't know if computer graphics can quite capture that yet.
I don't think so. No. You know, it also just might be personal bias in it, and the appreciation of hand-drawn animation sometimes a little bit more than the 3D animation. I think that's not insulting the format. I just sometimes it feels like the technology of animation kind of outweighs the actual look and feel and movements of the characters. Like when you take a step forward and all of a sudden you have Sully, who his hair is so realistic, you're looking at that. You're not necessarily looking at the characterizations of the character. You're looking at how impressive the design is that they can achieve so much. So I think there are glimpses of it in the world that we live in with 3D animation, but for 2D, they sure figured that out pretty quickly early on, especially with, as what you said, with characters like Stromboli with Chernabog. You get that right away.
Yeah. And about Chernabog, Tytla said, "I'm Ukrainian. My father was a Ukrainian cavalryman. On all my animation, I tried to do some research and look into the background of each character. I studied Italians for weeks to do Stromboli. but I could relate immediately to this character. Ukrainian folklore is based on Chernobog. Mussorgsky used terms I could understand. The Disney version on Night on Bald Mountain closely followed the original program attached to Mussorgsky's printed score, which read, "A subterranean din of earthly voices, appearance of the spirits of darkness, followed by that of Chernobog, glorification of the black god, the black mass, the revelry of witches' Sabbath, interrupted from afar by the bell of a little church, whereupon the spirits of evil disperse. Dawn breaks." The Disney version of Chernobog was derived from a pencil sketch by Albert Herder. He had never animated for Disney. Walt hired him for his amazing visual imagination. Herder was paid to create pencil sketches that would inspire other Disney artists. Herder's sketch of a demon unfurling his wings on a mountaintop suggested the idea of Chernobog. So that's all Herder did. They said he just sat by himself and all he did was draw all day. So. To design the Witch's Sabbath, Walt hired Kay Nielsen, a contemporary illustrator of myths and fairy tales. Children today may know his work for the book East of the Sun, West of the Moon, which is a collection of 15 fairy tales. And I have this book. I used to, when I taught primary grades, this was a book I read every year. So a book to add to Rory's library when he's a little older.
When we want to scare him terribly.
Now, these are Norwegian fairy tales. Okay. So they're nice fairy tales.
Okay. Even better. Yeah.
Wilfred Jackson, who had directed the band concert, was chosen to direct the Night on Bald Mountain segment. Now, Jackson hired Bela Lugosi, best known for his film portrayal of Dracula as the live-action reference for Chernobog. However, Lugosi did not move the way Tytla envisioned Chernobog would move. So after Lugosi left, Tytla told the skinny Wilfred Jackson to take off his shirt and move the way Tytla directed him for the camera. Using this live-action reference, the character model created by the character model department, and his own imagination, Tytla animated Chernobog. Yeah. Although I still think I still see a little bit of Lugosi in the facial features.
For sure in the facial features, but really, I mean, Lugosi as Dracula, he tried to move with so much grace, and the thing that is different about Chernobog is there's power in Chernobog's movements. There's action in it, and Dracula was always more about the flow and the subtlety of how he moved around. So I feel like there's a little bit in the kind of the angles of the face with it, but definitely not in the movements. That was not working.
Yeah, I agree with you there. So said Mark Davis of Tytla's work on Chernobog, "It was one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life. I think that was the high point. The whole thing comes to life. The moment of fear when the bell begins to toll stands out. But I like the shape of this whole thing. It was enormous. But you see, this could only happen at the Disney studio because it wasn't only Bill. You had Kay Nielsen who sketched this thing up, and it was pretty much as it was on the screen. You had sculptors who made all the models, and you had Bill Tytla, who was just right at that moment to do something like this. He had all the art in the world in him at that moment." In the early story conferences for this sequence, Walt was worried that he was overreaching, saying, "What I'm thinking about is this. We have done cartoon and comic bats and cats, and we have used graves and spooks from graves. It's quite obvious there is nothing new about it. In this thing, we are attempting to do something bigger than we are able to handle, to tell the truth. We want to go beyond those obvious things we have done. We're getting all mixed up here and nothing is coming out of it. It's just an attempt to do something big, but it's falling flat. We have to do more than just a bunch of pictures on the screen." This sequence was a long way from the first time Walt and his artist explored the theme of Halloween in the first Silly Symphony, The Skeleton Dance, in 1929, which was a comic story treatment. In A Night on Bald Mountain, the Disney artists were creating Satan and other evil spirits who roam the earth in search of souls. The visual impact of the sequence was due to the design of the demons by Kay Nielsen, the choreography as they sailed through the sky by Terrell Strapp and Charles Pazant, the animation supervision and animation by Bill Tytla, William Scholl, Don Patterson, and others who created the realism of the creatures, and witches riding wild boars, warriors riding skeletons of horses and cows, and the souls of those not buried in consecrated ground, and living humans who sold their souls to the devil, and the special effects animation and camera effects by Daniel McManus, which included some of the scenes in which flames dancing on Chernabog's hands transform into the shapes of the damned. McManus was told they should give the impression of being female forms, but if they look like women, they're no good. And if they don't look like women, they're no good. This direction led to the powerful scene in which the shapes of three women change into the shapes of a wolf, pig, and goat, then into six demons. Chernabog turns his hand over, then back, as the demons scramble over his hand before Chernabog closes his hand and crushes them. When he opens his hand, he reveals they have become six flames. Wilfred Jackson's hands were used as the models for Chernabog's hands. Towards the end of this sequence, our point of view changes. Up until now, we have been looking down into the fiery pit as Chernabog casts demons into the flames. Suddenly, we look up from the pit into his face, and the bell begins to toll. He glances up and recoils from the sound and puts up an arm as if to defend himself against a blow. He then appears to be in agony and defeated, folds his wings, and transforms back into the mountain. When asked how he approached the animation of Chernabog, Titus said, "I imagined that I was big as a mountain and made of rock, and yet I was feeling and moving." So I have always said, Craig, that Chernabog is my favorite Disney villain. Like you said, he's very powerful, but he is so evil and frightening. You know, even though, you know, this is really the only film he's in except, well, that film they used to have at, you know, Disney MGM Studios where he gets in Michael Eisner's way in the theater. But otherwise, he's just such a powerful character.
For sure. Easily. The most menacing Disney villain, in my opinion, and maybe not my favorite, but I just can't think of another Disney villain who's had such an impact on Disney. And it's not just because of the sequence as a whole, it's because of Chernabog himself. Like, in how I specifically am mentioning this is, think about all the nighttime shows that use the music, I'm not going to say the composer's name, from Night at Bald Mountain. Think about why that's being used. I mean, yeah, they sometimes throw Chernabog's image in, but it's because that the music has become synonymous with our fear of Chernabog over the years since Fantasia has been released. It's been that he's been so captivating that that music has attached to that character. Like we've talked about with other sequences where, you know, the fact that now that you hear that music, you only think of it as Fantasia, not by itself. This is that case all over again, in that you see Chernabog, you hear the music, you see Chernabog, doesn't matter either way. And it has come to be synonymous with the idea of a villain, with the idea of the darkest times in so many Disney nighttime shows. Like, that's just what's used now, and you hear it and it takes you right back to that moment, the first time you saw it, heard it, experienced it. And I can't you know, I could think of other little moments where they use music from Disney villains to try to evoke the same idea, but it's never quite the same. Honestly, I know they push sometimes with like Ursula and Poor Unfortunate Souls, but never at the same level. It's mm-hmm. as soon as you hear the no, and all the music starts to swivel in. It's like, you know where it's going, and that's going to the darkest point. And it's incredible. It's incredible how much it has transformed Disney just by this one short little sequence in a movie, however many years ago.
Yeah. And how it's transformed the music. Like you brought up something interesting where there's a couple of selections out of here where if you go to a concert hall and hear them performed, you're immediately going to think, like if you hear the Sorcerer's Apprentice performed, you're going to think of Mickey Mouse. Mm-hmm. And if you hear Night on Bald Mountain performed, you're going to think of this selection, the yep. Night on Bald Mountain with Chernabog and all these demons. It's like my generation, if we heard the William Tell Overture, we immediately thought of the Lone Ranger. Yeah. And so it's interesting how, even though maybe Fantasia wasn't well received, we'll get into that in a bit, the music, these musical pieces have become so associated with Fantasia, they sort of lost the reason why their composers originally created them.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. And I, honestly, though, it's not a thing that it worked this way with every single one of the pieces, because the next piece we're going to be talking about, it's one of, in my opinion, one of the most beautiful compositions mm-hmm. that it's ever been created. But there is nothing about it when I hear it in the real world, when I hear it in other instances, that I'm like, oh, yes, that beautiful sequence to end Fantasia. I never connect it with that. But that's not the same with Night on Bald Mountain or Sorcerer's Apprentice. Those couple pieces, that Nutcracker, it's a life outside of the movie, and that's so special.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I agree. So speaking of Ave Maria, during a story meeting in December 1938, Walt and his story team had just listened to Schubert's Ave Maria, and Walt was looking at the storyboard sketches of the pilgrims progressing to church when one of the storymen said, "I always wonder if we're taking full advantage of the cartoon medium with a picture like this." This annoyed Walt, and he retorted, "This is not the cartoon medium. It should not be limited to cartoons. We have worlds to conquer here. The best answer I can think of is this, that we've got an hour and 45 minutes of picture, and we're doing beautiful things with beautiful music. We're doing comic things, fantastic things, and it can't be all the same. It's an experimental thing, and I'm willing to experiment on it. We've got more in this medium than making people laugh. We love to make people laugh, but I think we can do both." Now, it's worth noting what Walt's competitors were creating at the time whilst Walt was creating Fantasia. Max Fleischer had received an Academy Award nomination for Hunky and Spunky, but Walt was awarded it for Ferdinand the Bull. And actually, the Disney studio had received 4 Academy Award nominations that year. MGM was animating characters from the Captain and the Kids comic strip. Porky Pig and Daffy Duck were the breakout stars at Warner Brothers. Walter Lantz was still creating Oswald the Lucky Rabbit cartoons. Paul Terry finally created his first color cartoon based on Jack and the Beanstalk. This was the state of animation when Walt Disney was working on his Ave Maria segment. Of Ave Maria, Walt said, "This covers 4 minutes in our picture, and it's going to be 4 precious minutes when we're through. The beauty we can get from controlled color and the music and everything we use here will be worth it. This stuff means more. It's richer, like a painting. People go all over Europe to look at cathedrals, and when you go in, they don't look like this. You don't see the beauty there. You have to get back and squint your eyes, or you have to see it at a certain hour or a certain minute of the day." Now, the Ave Maria sequence was planned to be the greatest showcase for the talents of background painters, with support from the dramatic camera angles by the layout man and special photographic images from the effects animators and camera department. The sequence begins with a stunning cross dissolve. Tytla had animated Chernabog to fold his wings and turn back into the mountaintop. Then the camera chucks in and the screen is filled with drifting fog. This shot was created with the multiplane camera to give an illusion of the depth in the scene. Out of the 11,200 feet of film used for Fantasia, 3,500 feet of it was footage created with the multiplane camera. This was more than was used in both Snow White and Pinocchio. Lights move into the scene from camera left across to camera right, obscured by the drifting fog. The procession crosses a bridge, and they are also obscured by the fog. Fog and mist are very challenging to animate because you can't put a pencil line around them. The light from the candles reflect in the water below, forming a cross in the reflection. Then the ripples break up the reflection. Now in a panorama taking up 118 feet of film, the figures become visible through the fog, and Gothic trees emerge as the procession climbs the hill. The lights suggest stained glass windows, and the tree forms give the impression of the arched sanctuary of a church. Still in a long shot, the pilgrims walk along the edge of a lake. The camera moves down to the reflections on the water, then moves ahead of the reflections, and the scene ends on a quiet, dark area of the lake. Most of Ave Maria's animation was experimental for the studio. Some of the closest animation ever done at the studio was the animation of the pilgrims in the long pan. The slower the movement in animation, the more drawings there are, and the closer together is each successive drawing of the same figure. The animation of the same figure is so close that the difference of the width of a pencil line could cause jitters. That's also called strobing in the animation. Strobing occurs when the successive images of a progressive movement are not fused by the persistence of vision, causing the images to move in a series of short staccato jumps or to jitter. Walt was continually dissatisfied with the look of Ave Maria and ordered expensive and time-consuming retakes. He was also faced with the realities of the war in Europe. The European market was now closed, affecting the profit margin for Pinocchio. By the end of 1940, it was clear to Walt that Pinocchio would not recover its cost of $2.6 million. And Bambi would not be completed until 1942. Now much more was riding on the success of Fantasia. But instead of rushing to get the film into theaters, Walt's reaction was to get it perfect.
And that's the exact right mindset to have, because if the movie was only going to be around for a year and then disappear and never be known, rush it, get it out there, try to make the money, move on. But when Walt was creating these movies, this art that was hopefully going to last generations and generations beyond him, you want the perfect version of it last. I mean, we use the same mindset when we're creating some videos with the Diz, is that, there are plenty of people who are happy to record a subpar version on their phone or smaller version on the camera in a lower quality and just get it up as quick as possible to get views and start getting eyes on it. But even if we don't get the most views right away, if we're happier with our quality, if it still looks good in another 10 years from now, where those other ones are unwatchable because of the lesser quality, then ultimately we won in the long run. And, mm-hmm. So Walt was not wrong for his way of thinking back then, of getting it perfect versus getting that instant success by getting it done without costing more money.
Yeah, and then and look now even how these are considered classics. People watch these early films over and over and over again. And also Walt thought, you know, Fantasia would be one of a series, that it would be re-released every couple of years with new segments, replacing, you know, some of the segments from the original feature. So, so that was the other reason he wanted this to be perfect.
Yeah, so, totally see why.
Now, Walt was considering having the Madonna appear at the end of Ave Maria and had not made a final decision. He wanted a good finish for the film. On August 2nd, 1940, Walt, six artists, and a secretary met to view the Ave Maria reel. Walt was displeased with the jitter in the lights and figures. It was determined the issue was from the inking and painting. Walt said it could not be used. For the next 90 minutes, Walt and his artists discussed how they could fix this problem. The solution would be time-consuming and expensive. Walt was determined to get this sequence right when he said the previous January, "Pretty scenes aren't going to carry this. It must be like a spectacle on stage. It can't be too literal in its interpretation. It must glorify the sacred side as Bear Mountain does, the profane side. It is too subtle this way. There must be a bigness to it to fit the way we expect to present the music." In an early story conference where they discussed combining A Night on Bald Mountain with Ave Maria, Walt said, "The forces of good on one side and of evil on the other is what I am trying to see in this thing." When Walt told the special effects artists what he wanted for Ave Maria, it was only a few weeks until the premiere of Fantasia. The problem was, there was no animation camera that could move slowly and continuously enough to make that last panoramic shot. But Walt wanted it. In their book, Disney Animation, The Illusion of Life, Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston wrote how Walt got that shot. "A couple of cameramen, two or three carpenters, two inventors, and an artist tackled the project." Walt told the carpenters to take out the seats at the end of the soundstage, which was about 45 feet across, shut down the recording sessions, and, quote, "go ahead." Then they constructed a horizontal camera crane that would photograph artwork painted on panes of glass 3 or 4 feet wide. The camera was placed on a carriage that could move along a track. The painted glass was mounted on movable stands so they could be shifted out of the way as the camera moved through the paintings of the forest, then through the paintings of the window-shaped light, and onto the painting of the sunburst. All the while, the cameramen quickly calibrated the camera moves so they could control the real light and avoid any reflections on the glass. They shot for 6 days and six nights, with the carpenters, inventors, and artists standing by so they could quickly fix anything that broke or went wrong. According to Thomas and Johnston, the only time they had a break was when Walt played badminton on the stage from 7 to 10 p.m. When filming was completed, everyone went to bed exhausted. After the film was processed at the lab, they all gathered to view the scene the next day. It didn't jerk or wobble at all. To their dismay, though, it was unusable. The wrong lens had been placed in the camera. Not only did the camera film the beautiful artwork, it photographed the camera track, the stands that held the artwork, and some of the workers. It all had to be done over, and the New York premiere was only days away. The crew shot for 3 days and nights, and it all had to be perfect this time. It was going well. They took breaks for the badminton games and lived on coffee. Then there was an earthquake. The line of wooden stands holding the painted glass scenes rocked, but nothing broke nor even cracked. After waiting to see if there were any aftershocks, the crew checked the equipment to make sure the track was still straight and that nothing had changed because there was no time to reshoot the scene. The next morning, they started all over again. badminton games were canceled. Walt said no one but the crew could be on stage. They rolled the camera back to the starting point, put in new film, checked and double-checked that the correct lens was in the camera, and began shooting. They finished with one day to spare. It was sent off to the lab for processing. It was then viewed, and it was perfect. Before flying to New York for the film's premiere, Walt had given instructions for some last-minute changes to the soundtrack. The last reel of Fantasia and Walt were on the same plane to New York. They both landed in New York 4 hours before the premiere. As soon as the reel arrived at the Broadway Theater, it was spliced onto the end of the film. The Broadway Theater was previously named the Colony Theater and was where Steamboat Willie had premiered just 12 years earlier. Whilst the film was praised by the New York Times movie critic as simply terrific as anything that has ever happened on screen, the film's returns from its initial release fell far short of its $2.3 million. Partly to blame was the start of World War II, which closed European markets that previously accounted for as much as 45% of Disney's revenue. Also, critical reviews were mixed. Some accused Walt of being pretentious. Parents said they didn't want to pay the high ticket price because the Night on Bald Mountain sequence frightened their children. So before we keep going, though, Craig, I just found the whole, what went into that last 4 minutes of that film amazing, creating Ave Maria.
Yeah, it's just pure insanity. Like, that's the kind of behind the scenes stuff I love hearing about, because I mean, you just can't imagine it in your head as you're watching it. Like, you wouldn't sit down and watch that and be like, oh, you know, it's just animation. It's done how it's done in every other thing. Without getting that full blown explanation, you can't fathom it. And then even once they explain it all, and then how many times, you know, having to redo it, like, it's just, it hurts my head. And I don't know if I'm more impressed by that or the fact that they were taking so many badminton breaks for such a long time, but what a story.
I have to think Walt took those badminton breaks so they would have a rest.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably it. And, you know, at least then it's like, okay, rest and, you know, exercise the body, and you're exercising the mind too. But it's just so weird. Like, out of 3 hours of badminton, that's when you get to take breaks. So wacky.
Yeah. Yeah. But this all just makes me appreciate this film even more.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you know what, though? The hard part is, you hear that stuff, you know what Walt was going for with it. If he's accused of being pretentious, there's an argument that's made. That's easily made there that, yeah, maybe he was being pretentious, but at the same time, I feel like that's how you expand the medium. That's how you get to that next level. That's how you capture an audience you weren't capturing before. I mean, you could make the same argument about just operas or ballets in general. Yeah, those can be pretentious, but that doesn't mean that there isn't an audience out there for it. Mm-hmm. So if you want to move on beyond saying we're just cartoons, we're kids entertainment, you have to find places and moments like what Fantasia did, so that way it can move beyond it.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So now, RKO was not happy with having to distribute Fantasia, which it described as a long hair musical, and believed its duration of 2 hours and 5 minutes plus intermission was too long for a general release. So RKO relaxed its exclusive distribution contract with the Walt Disney Studio, as Walt wanted a more prestigious limited-run roadshow attraction. 13 roadshows were held across the United States, each consisting of 2 daily screenings with seat reservations booked in advance at higher prices and a 15-minute intermission. The studio hired film salesman Irving Ludwig to manage the first 11 engagements. Ludwig was given specific instructions regarding each aspect of the film's presentation, including the setup of outside theater marquees and curtain and lighting cues. Patrons are taken to their seats by staff hired and trained by Disney team members and were given an illustrated program booklet. And I have one of those booklets. It is exquisite in its illustrations. They look like watercolors and they have beautiful descriptions. It also has photographs from behind the scenes, like the orchestra rehearsing, things like that. And it gives a little explanation as to what went into the creation of the film.
Yeah. If it ever needs a good home, I have a sturdy bookshelf.
Yeah. But I mean, this is lavish for, I even in the '60s, they were still giving out programs like these. Like I have one for 2001, A Space Odyssey, The Greatest Story Ever Told, and a couple of other films. It was part of the theatrical experience.
Yeah, I wish they did that more. I feel like they did a program when they did The Hateful Eight, because I know they ran that as when it was shown in 70mm. I feel like they made that more of a big production in that way, and I feel like there was a program attached to it. But I wish they would get back to doing that. And I believe we started this episode talking about how we wish there was intermissions in movies again. Yes. And more of that spectacle. So yeah, I wish that was a trend that came back around.
Yeah, I agree. The first roadshow opened at the Broadway Theater in New York City on November 30th, 1940. Walt and Roy had negotiated a year's lease with the venue that was fully equipped with Fantasound, which took personnel a week working around the clock to install. Proceeds made on the night went to the British War Relief Society for their efforts in the Battle of Britain. Ticket demand was so great that 8 telephone operators were employed to handle the extra calls, whilst the adjoining store was rented out to cater the box office bookings. Fantasia ran at the Broadway for 49 consecutive weeks, the longest run achieved by a film at the time. It would run for 57 weeks until February 8th, 1942. The remaining 12 roadshows were held throughout 1941, which included a 39-week run at the Carthay Circle Theater in Los Angeles from January 29th. Fantasia broke the long-run record at the Carthay Circle in its 28th week, a record previously held by Gone with the Wind. Its 8-week run at the Fulton Theater in Pittsburgh drew in over 50,000 people, with reservations being made from cities located 100 miles from the venue. Roadshows were held at the Geary Theater in San Francisco for 8 months. I know the Geary Theater well. The Hanna Theater in Cleveland for 9 weeks. The Majestic Theater in Boston. The Apollo Theater in Chicago. And also in Philadelphia, Detroit, Buffalo, Minneapolis, Washington, D.C., and Baltimore. Fantasia grossed over $300,000 in its first 16 weeks in New York, over $20,000 in the opening 5 weeks in San Francisco, and almost the same amount in the first 10 weeks in both Los Angeles and Boston. The first 11 roadshows earned a total of $1.3 million by April 1941, but the $85,000 in production and installation costs of a single Fantasound setup, along with the theaters having to be leased, resulted in the studio exceeding their loan limits. Then the onset of the Second World War prevented Fantasia from being released in Europe. Normally the source, as I said, as much as 45% of the studio's income. Up to 88 engagements were planned over 5 years. But wartime demands for material limited the number of Fantasound prints to 16. All but one of the Fantasound setups were dismantled and given to the war effort. When RKO acquired the film's distribution rights in April 1941, they initially continued the roadshow booking policy, but presented the film in mono, which was easier to exhibit. The combined average receipts from each roadshow were approximately $325,000, which made Fantasia an even greater financial loss than Pinocchio. The box office failures of Pinocchio, Fantasia, and the delay of Bambi put the studio in a serious financial situation, forcing Walt and Roy to lay off almost half of their staff, which contributed to the animator strike in 1941. Walt allowed RKO to handle the general release of Fantasia, but was against their desire to have the film cut. He finally relented because the studio needed as much income as possible to remedy its dire financial situation. But Walt refused to cut it himself, saying, "You can get anybody you want to edit it. I can't do it." With no input from Walt, musical director Ed Plum and Ben Sharpstein cut Fantasia first to 1 hour and 40 minutes, then to 1 hour and 20 minutes, by removing most of Dean Taylor's commentary and the Toccata and Fugue segment. Fantasia was re-released in January 1942 at more popular prices with a mono soundtrack and was placed on the lower half of double bills with the Western film Valley of the Sun, which starred Lucille Ball, James Craig, and Sir Cedric Hardwick. So being at the lower half of the double bill, that really affected its notoriety whatever.
No,
I
mean, and it's a bad thing. It's like when in our modern days, since we don't really have double features anymore except at drive-ins, it's like being on the second movie at a drive-in where it's like, yeah, you know, I really only came for the first one. Maybe I'll stay for the second one, but it's kind of late. I'd rather get going home. It's that same exact mindset. It's there, but it's more of an afterthought.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was an insult actually to Fantasia for that to happen.
No, I completely agree with that. I get the issues that people had with it and the struggles, but at the same time too, it's like, I feel like you either have to accept the loss or maybe you just accept the loss and you leave it at that and not let all the meddling happen. But obviously it did. And I feel like Fantasia is on the right side of history, at least now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. RKO reissued Fantasia once more on September 1st, 1946, with the animated sequences complete and the scenes of Taylor Stokowski and the orchestra restored but shortened. Its running time was restored to 1 hour and 45 minutes. This edit would be the standard form for future releases, including the 1990 restoration. On February 26, 1942, the Motion Picture Academy of Arts and Sciences honored Fantasia at its annual Oscar ceremony. The Board of Governors voted to present Fantasia with 2 special awards. Both were presented by Academy President and 20th Century Fox mogul Daryl F. Zanuck. The first went to Walt and the developers of Fantasound for outstanding contribution to the advancement for the use of sound in motion pictures through the production of Fantasia. The second was presented to Stokowski and his associates for their unique achievement in the creation of a new form of visualized music in Walt Disney's production of Fantasia, thereby widening the scope of the motion picture as an art form. That same evening, Walt became the 4th producer ever to receive the Irving G. Thalberg Memorial Award, occasionally given for consistent creativity and excellence in production. The previous Thalberg honoree, David O. Selznick, presented the award, and while it was for Walt's body of work and not Fantasia specifically, he praised the groundbreaking Disney feature, saying, "in which established music was used as the complete basis for the creation of the picture, which contributed to the musical education of the public." So at least Walt was vindicated.
Exactly.
In this, Walt and his team.
So. Yeah, and I mean, in this day and age now, too, I feel like sometimes when movies bomb, the directors, producers are still happy as long as it gets its critical acclaim and appreciation by the peers in the industry, rather than, you know, it, you know, getting the big returns on it. However, the big returns also allow you to continue making movies, and that trust, unless, you know, there's some, I feel like, that work on a balance right now, like especially in our culture, where like Dune 2 is gonna you know, beat out what it costs to make the movie, not go above and beyond it. And usually in the current day of the industry, that wouldn't be enough to be able to greenlight a sequel to that one even. But because it's so critically beloved and everyone appreciates it in Hollywood, that's going to be enough to make it happen. And so, yeah, it's sad that didn't make money the way it should have, but it's actually better that the rest of Hollywood saw it and appreciated it and honored Walt in that way for it.
Yeah, I think I'm glad that it got its recognition it deserved. Though the studio would soon find commercial success again with Dumbo, which used a much simpler and less expensive style of animation, Walt would never complete the planned sequels to Fantasia. Looking back, Walt said, "Oh, Fantasia, well, we made it and I don't regret it, but if we had to do it all over again, I don't think we'd do it." Although they did, you know, some of the segments that were being planned for, you know, later versions of Fantasia made it into the package films, like Make Mine Music and Melody Time and all that. So those are like mini Fantasias in a way.
Exactly. Yeah, no, they worked. You know, the animation not always as beautiful, a little bit cruder. I'm sad that we didn't get more, because like, I haven't tried. I think it's on YouTube still. And when they re-released a Fantasia on Blu-ray, I know they included like the Claire de Lune sequence that was cut from the original one. And that to me was, I think that's up there with anything they put in Fantasia. I mean, it's also one of my favorite written pieces of music, but the whole sequence is just so, so beautiful. And like, I wish there would have been more Fantasias, so that could have been in there. And when they re-released the Blu-ray, they put it on there, but it was weird because it was like you had to be connected to the internet and you would click on it and then it would open up like a browser to be able to watch it. It was just so weird why they didn't include it on the disc. Will never make sense to me, but it is out there to see, but I would have loved to had like actual better physical copies of this, because they made more Fantasias down the road.
Yeah. And actually it's interesting because Claire de Lune was going to be the end, and then Walt replaced it with Ave Maria.
Yeah. And we didn't really talk that much about Ave Maria with it, but I love the look of the sequence for Ave Maria. I don't love the actual orchestration of it. I think it's probably the weakest piece of music throughout the entire thing. It's definitely not the best version of Ave Maria out there at all that you could listen to. And it's I feel like it ends on a weaker note because of that, even though the visuals of it are so breathtaking and so much work went into it. But something like Claire de Lune, if it would have ended on that music, a complete different ending in a way. You would have been left wanting more, in my opinion.
See, and I love Ave Maria. It's because I guess emotionally, because it was sung at Carol's funeral at her request, and at both her parents' funerals as well. And it'll probably be sung at mine.
I love it. And I just think with me, Ave Maria, the simpler it is, the better, the more emotion you get. When it's just like a one piano or a guitar and a vocalist, I feel like that's when it's at its best. And it's almost too much in Fantasia. It doesn't work as well for me, but it's a small little problem.
Now, the Walt Disney Company continued to re-release Fantasia. By 1955, the original sound negatives began to deteriorate. Luckily, a 4-track copy had survived in good condition. Using the one remaining Fantasound system at the studio, a 3-track stereo copy was transferred across telephone wires onto the magnetic film at an RCA facility in Hollywood. This copy was used when Fantasia was reissued in stereo by Buena Vista Distribution in Superscope, a derivative of the widescreen CinemaScope format, on February 7, 1956. This reissue received criticism from viewers, as the widescreen format led to the cropping and reframing of the images.
An issue I still have today, every time I'm trying to watch something that's 4x3 and they crop it to 16x9 for our TVs. I'm like, I understand you can only watch so much before your TV gets the burn in on the sides, which doesn't really happen anymore with higher end TVs. Like, it's those days are gone. Just show me the freaking movies and TV shows in the original way they were created.
Yeah.
That's how I want to see them.
I agree. A Fantasia soundtrack recording was not released until 1957, after the creation of Disneyland Records in 1956. A deluxe 3LP record set with a 24-page insert book with text by Deems Taylor and illustrations adapted from the film by Disney animation artists Al Dempster, Dick Kelsey, and Art Riley, who had all worked on the film. I have that, actually, too. So, and it is. It's beautiful. So. On February 20th, 1963, Fantasia was re-released in both standard and Superscope versions with stereo sound. This was the final release before Walt's passing in 1966. Fantasia finally made a profit from its $2.3 million budget after its December 17th, 1969 release. This was when the film was promoted with a psychedelic-styled advertising campaign, and it became popular amongst teenagers and college students who were reported to have taken drugs for a psychedelic experience whilst viewing the film. This is the version with the edited pastoral symphony sequence we talked about in our previous episode.
And I love that it's kind of it entered a wider version of the universe outside of just Disney, because there's a small part of the Adam Sandler movie Big Daddy when they come across a homeless Steve Buscemi who is just completely out of it. And when the little kid in it asks how he got there, he cites that maybe he watched Fantasia too much growing up, which that's always I mean when I first saw that, I was like, I don't understand that joke. How could Fantasia do that? And then it's like, oh, in the 60s it became part of the drug culture. Okay, that makes more sense now.
I have a small theater poster from that era that someone gave me that it is all the psychedelic,
that's cool,
oranges and pinks and all of that stuff that I have in I think it's in that record album. I keep it in there.
So. That's awesome. Yeah, I'm sure there was a lot of those floating around the San Francisco area back in the 60s.
Yeah. Fantasia was issued on a regular basis, typically for exhibition in art houses in college towns, until the mid-1970s. The film was reissued nationwide on April 15, 1977, this time with simulated stereo sound. In this version, the RKO distribution logo was replaced with the Buena Vista distribution logo, since RKO had not been a part of a release since 1946. It had not been removed earlier because the credit sequence would have needed to have been reshot. In 1980, Irving Ludwig, who had managed Fantasia's 1940 roadshow engagements, had returned to Walt Disney Productions in 1959 to become president of Buena Vista Distributions. He said, "Walt was at least 25 years ahead of his time, and the public wasn't ready for Fantasia just yet. In 1969, however, the 18 to 30-year-olds finally discovered it, the very audience we had been wooing all the time. Since then, it has been in continuous release in selected theaters across the country. Fantasia will always be my all-time favorite picture." For the 1982 and 85 releases, Fantasia had a completely new soundtrack recorded in Dolby Stereo. First released on April 2, 1982, this version of the film marked the first time a film soundtrack had been digitally re-recorded in its entirety. To replace Stokowski's recordings, film conductor Erwin Kostel was hired. He directed a 121-piece orchestra and a 50-voice choir for the recording that took place over 18 sessions and cost $1 million. To maintain continuity with the animation, Kostel based his performance on the tempos and pacing of the Stokowski recordings. However, as we mentioned earlier, for Night on Bald Mountain, he used Mussorgsky's original orchestration instead of Leopold Stokowski's own version that was part of the original soundtrack. The new recording also corrected a 2-frame lag in projection caused by the old recording techniques used in the 1930s. Deems Taylor scenes were deleted, and a much briefer voiceover narration was recorded by Hugh Douglas because the studio felt the modern audience, quote, is more sophisticated and knowledgeable about music, unquote. This version was again released to about 400 theaters in 1985, this time with actor Tim Matheson as the narrator. For its 50th anniversary, Fantasia returned to 550 theaters on October 5, 1990, in its traditional 1946 version, including the live-action scenes with Taylor and the original Stokowski score. The film underwent a 2-year restoration process after a 6-month search to piece together the original negatives that had been in storage since 1946. This was the first time that a release of the film had been processed from the original and not from a copy. Theaters were required to have specific stereo equipment installed and to present the film in its original aspect ratio with black borders on the side of their screens. The Stokowski soundtrack was digitally remastered using the 1955 magnetic soundtrack, with an estimated 3,000 pops and hisses being removed in the process. This reissue of Fantasia grossed $25 million. I remember Carol and I went to see this at the Tower Theater in Sacramento, and there was a line of parents asking for refunds because of the Night on Bald Mountain sequence.
Some things just never change, I guess.
I know. When Fantasia was released to home video on November 1st, 1991, it became the highest-selling VHS cassette of all time in the United States, selling 14.2 million copies. And I still have that. I think it's in the garage somewhere.
I can remember going over to friends' houses, and it was in so many houses. Everyone seemed to have a cassette of Fantasia. But oddly enough, that was one that my family did not own.
Oh, how funny.
Maybe my parents were scared of the Night on Bald Mountain sequence.
Maybe. But, you know, I don't think a film – you're our film expert here at the Diz. I don't think any film in its re-releases has gone through so many changes and restorations as Fantasia.
Maybe now at this point, there could have been, especially, but I mean, not theatrically released over and over and over again, because that's something that Disney does. But I feel like, you know, looking at something like Wizard of Oz, every time they have a new anniversary, another 5 years, they're like, okay, well, we've got to now do another 4K.
That's true.
So some, maybe a couple things like that, but given the factor in of how many times it was re-released in theaters over the years and different techniques and formats, Fantasia's probably still up there in terms of movies we still watch to this day.
Mm-hmm. You know, the Muppet movie's being re-released to theaters, I think, in June. It'd be interesting to see if they've done anything to restore that or digitally, I don't know, enhance the soundtrack or anything like that.
Damn. It's, as far as I know, none of the Muppet movies have, except for Muppet Christmas Carol, that has been remastered in 4K, and they did that with when they did the, you know, brought back in the version on Disney Plus that you can watch with the cut song When Love Is Gone. But I don't know if any of the other ones have gone through that process yet. Because, you know, usually if they're going to go through the effort, then they're also going to do a 4K re-release. Mm-hmm. And that hasn't happened yet. But maybe one day.
It wouldn't surprise me, because it's a Fathom Events production, a lot of times when Fathom Events re-releases, it's associated with a remastered version being released to home video.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knows? Maybe they have plans for it. I think because Sony owns the rights for Muppets Take Manhattan and which other one? Muppets from Space. I think they were working on 4K restorations and versions, or they were outsourcing it to another company, maybe like Shout Factory. But I know that was kind of in the works, but I don't know for any of the ones that Disney owns. And honestly, I don't think the Blu-ray versions looked that bad. And there's only so much you can do to make older movies look better. Like, it's just, you can only go so far with it. And I don't even bother seeing a lot of those re-releases, because digitally you're watching a lesser version of it. If they would bring back versions of Fathom Events where you're watching, you know, restored original film versions shot in, you know, you're watching it in theater on 35 millimeter cameras with, or 35 millimeter projectors actually displaying film, then I would go see those. But I hate repaying to watch a digital version that I can just watch at home. Mm-hmm. But I'm picky about that stuff.
Yeah, but it's nice to see them on a big screen with the,
yeah.
I just saw My Fair Lady not long ago, and yeah. So it was fun to see it again in the big screen.
For as much as I love movies and I tell people to go see them, that's the one thing that I'm weird about, is I just don't like going to see re-releases when it's not in a form, unless it's like we have a small theater here in Orlando, the Endeon, that they'll still show older movies on film, and that I will always go and see, because that's spectacular.
Yeah, I agree. So, in 2017, an off-Broadway play debuted in New York by Frederick Stropel titled Small World, which imagined the meetings and conversations between Walt Disney and Igor Stravinsky whilst developing Fantasia's Rite of Spring sequence. Mark Shanahan portrayed Walt Disney, and Stephen D'Ambrose was Stravinsky. I looked up some of the reviews on this. I don't know if you did, Craig, because I think we talked about it. I don't know if we talked about it during the show or, you know.
I think we talked after, because I was going to look up more information on Ask Friends to see if I could find out more. I got nothing on it besides the reviews.
Yeah, that's all I got. Well, first of all, the reviews for the actors were very good. The reviews on the performance just went from this was delightful to this is the most boring, dreadful thing I've ever seen. So there was like nothing in the middle there. So you either really liked it or you didn't in this. It actually debuted somewhere else in 2015, and 2017 was its off-Broadway thing. Then I think I didn't see anything beyond this 2017 debut. And then, you know, a couple years later, the pandemic would have hit. So I don't think it's being performed anymore. So anyway, but interesting little blip there in history. I would have liked to have seen it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the photos of it, like, it looks intriguing. I mean, I know a photo can only say so much, and it's a plain set, but, like, there's a believability to the actual production there with Stravinsky and such. So, I wish I could have saw it.
Yeah. Anyway. Oh, well. Leopold Stokowski went on to become music director of the Houston Symphony and would live to be 95 years old, and he conducted all the way to the end. In later years, he said, "I often receive letters from people to say, 'Thank you for doing it,' meaning Fantasia, because I was always afraid to go to a concert hall. When I went to Fantasia, I heard the great master's music and realized I enjoyed it." Before they completed Fantasia, Walt Disney, Leopold Stokowski, and their artists and musicians created an animated concert. When it was released, Walt told Time magazine that he expected Fantasia to run for years, perhaps even after I'm gone. In 1951, Walt said, "I don't regret making it. It's what we should have been doing with our medium at the time." only the Walt Disney Studio could have created a film as innovative, creative, and beautiful as Fantasia. I hope our discussion of the history of Walt Disney's Fantasia will increase your appreciation and enjoyment of the film. And if you haven't seen it, that our conversations will inspire you to watch it. I know now I'm going to watch this again with a whole new appreciation. I mean, this movie's gone up on my list.
Yeah.
In my top tens. So Disney films. So
yep, it's one that I like rewatching every couple of years, and it's for me, it's not something you could just put on every day of the week, or I can't rewatch it too much, but it's one of those ones that when you give it enough time in between, I feel like you always walk away appreciating so much more of it.
It's also not one of those ones though for me that I can put on and like do housework. Have to watch this film.
Yep. Yeah. You have to be actively involved with it. The only I can't do that because, when I start hearing the music, I just, as we've talked about with it, I start piecing it all together in my head. And then I'm like, I just need to watch it. Like it's probably of all the, for the Disney Music Archives, whatever they call it now, we're putting out those beautiful CD sets there for years and years and years and have slowed down on it. Like the only one I don't listen to is the Fantasia one, because anytime I started to listen to it, I'm like, I'll just watch it. It's just easier to do that. But just so impressive. So many years later.
It is funny. I don't listen to the Fantasia soundtrack that much, because when I do, if it's something where, I'm in a place where I just need to listen to music, I can't really watch television, I then want to hear the original pieces. So then I'll listen to those rather than the Fantasia versions.
Yeah, they're the flaws in the system, unfortunately.
But now it's time for This Week in Disney History. All right. Is it my turn this week, Craig, to start? Your turn. Actually. Okay, go ahead. Yeah.
So I'm just going to go with a nice simple one from April 1st of 1974. That's when Pioneer Hall finally opened up at Fort Wilderness. And obviously, it's still here to this day, making people happy, keeping bellies full, because Pioneer Hall is the home of the Pioneer Players, who put on the Hoop-Dee-Doo musical review. And I love that it's been able to survive and sustain for so long. The show is, it's still so entertaining. It's, for some reason, that entire restaurant just elevates fried chicken in a way that it really shouldn't be elevated, but it just does. It's a small piece of history with Fort Wilderness that I hope never, ever, ever goes away. It might look like it's this old Pioneer Hall, this old log cabin looking building that's been there for years and years and years, and now it has been there for 50 years, and I hope it lasts another 50, if not longer and longer.
So do I. I just love that area so much. I know they're going to ruin it by building some horrible monstrosity of a DVC tower, but I just love that whole – I think that area is beautiful. I always remember Pioneer Hall because we were waiting to see Hoop-Dee-Doo review. Kids were little, and I wandered over because there was this person selling Disney Vacation Club, and that was when there was one resort.
Yeah.
And I just go over there and look at it. It was like something crazy, like $25 a point or something nuts. And I called Carol over and said, look at this. And Carol immediately was dead set against it. Oh, we can't afford it. No, he thought it was silly. She came to regret that decision years later when we finally did buy into DVC. But, maybe it was the right decision at the time. But I still remember that. The right outside Pioneer Hall was learned about Disney Vacation Club.
That's a great memory. I mean, hey, who knows? If it didn't take off, it could have been one of those things that you always came to regret. Like, oh, look, there's one hotel that we don't even like that's not even being kept up anymore after all those years. Who knew it would become what it actually did?
Mm-hmm. They announced, you know, those you know how they're building that. What do they call it? The planned community in Palm Springs. It has this
Contino.
Yeah.
Contino.
Something like that, which I am worried they will not keep up and they would sell. I would never want to live in Palm Springs. I vowed if I ever move, it's not going to be in a place where there's no water.
Yeah. I don't have a high opinion of that area. Yeah. So,
yeah, I don't either. My daughter-in-law, though, sent me, this is a couple months ago or a month ago, sent me the link to the one in North Carolina that they've announced and said, this is only 8 hours from where we live. And I thought, oh, I just told her it's an interesting concept.
Yeah. The North Carolina one, I'm more on board with, but with Palm Springs, like I understand that Palm Springs is still very popular to this day. And I feel like people in your generation have like a mysticism with it, with like, oh, the celebrities go. And my dad's in that boat too. Like when he and I went to Southern California on vacation and together a couple years back, it was like, well, we've got to stop in Palm Springs. And I'm like, I don't get it. And like, I finally did stop there to go to a tiki bar one of the times that I was out there. And it's like, this is just full of a bunch of old people and potheads, and like that's it.
I went there once and I was passing through kind of thing. So I didn't stay for any length of time to really get to know it. And I told myself, why would anybody want to hang out here?
Yeah. So
I didn't find it visually appealing whatsoever.
Yeah, it's weird how, like, you know, they have managed to build a little oasis in the driest area, but it's not for me. But I do recommend the as you get off at one of the Palm Springs exits, one of the best In-N-Out burgers I've ever had was right outside of Palm Springs.
And I do want to go to Smoke Tree Ranch someday. Yeah, I want to see the house that had Ben Waltz.
Yeah.
Someday I would love to do that. But I don't know anybody that has an inn that could get me into Smoke Tree. That's all I want to do. I just want to see it and take a picture of it and then leave.
I mean, you could just put it out there now. I don't think you've ever had that request on the show before. So
no, that's true. You never know. Yeah. But anyway. So, well, mine is sad. And the reason that I chose this one, mainly because of everything I'm hearing about a documentary, I don't know if it's on Netflix or whatever right now, but it's about Nickelodeon and some of the horrors that happened to child actors at probably the time. These are probably shows your generation would have watched, Craig. My kids would have watched.
A lot of what happened was after my time. So you're talking about Quiet on the Set. It's streaming on Max right now. And because they started off with basically the guy who created all of the Nickelodeon shows, Dan Schneider. Like, he started with all that. And then that led to the Amanda Bynes show and from there. And so, like, my peak Nickelodeon was with all that. And by the time Amanda Bynes' show was on, like, I still was kind of interested, but at that point I had already started watching like sitcoms with my parents, Seinfeld and Friends. So I wasn't quite watching as much. And then the real horror stories that documentary revealed, that was after my time, but it was very, very eye-opening. I highly recommend people watch it. It'll make you just disgusted.
Yeah. And anyway, so I think on Nickelodeon, I remember my kids watched some show where they poured slime on you. I don't know.
Like everything.
Well, that's what I heard. But I don't think my kids just watched much Nickelodeon at all.
Yeah. I like the I like the cartoons, and then on Saturday they night I would watch Snick. So I would watch all that, Ren and Stimpy.
Yes.
Are You Afraid of the Dark?
And yes, they like, did watch that.
Like I would watch those, but I never like then once they kind of shifted into more of the like the Nickelodeon or the not Nickelodeon model, more of the Disney Channel where it started being like, okay, we're going to show you new shows from these young people from like 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock when you get home from school. That's when I didn't watch it anymore. I'm like, yeah. I miss the nighttime stuff that felt like I was a little adult, even though I was a kid.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think my kids are always busy right after that 4 to 6 o'clock thing. So they didn't watch it.
Yeah.
But so it was for that reason I'm choosing this. March 30th, 1968. Two children come across the lifeless body of a homeless man in an abandoned tenement building on East 10th Street in New York. No one could identify the body. No one had reported anybody missing. And so he was buried in an unmarked pauper's grave on Hart Island. They did, of course, you know, take his fingerprints and all that. Did an autopsy. In 1969, he was identified as being Bobby Driscoll, who, of course, we know is the voice of Peter Pan. He was in, you know, So Dear to My Heart and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Oh, no, I'm sorry, Treasure Island and, you know, a number of Disney films. And the cause, he died at 31. The cause of death was a heart attack. They think his history of alcohol and drug abuse was a strong contributing factor to his early death. And again, it's just because he was someone that really never found an identity or anything after Disney, after being a child actor. In what I've read about his life after that, he was married a couple of times, failed marriages. But you know, people teased him for his child acting. He was in Song of the South too, you know, his child acting days, which now, of course, he would have been a Disney legend. He would have been sought after, you know, at every Disney fan convention there was and all of that if he had lived long enough. But, you know, it's just so tragic.
Yeah, you know it's just really tough. I mean, the world of child actors, I feel like the odds are against you if you're a child actor. And it's great when you hear the success stories of people who made it out on the other side. But for every one of those stories, there's so many that go the opposite direction. Yeah. And the best ones that you can hear really are the ones where they rode the success well, and then they completely got out of the business and they found success doing something else entirely and were okay and satisfied with life. And but
for every Ron Howard, there's hundreds of others that turn out like Bobby Driscoll or some of the kids that were profiled in that documentary we were just talking about.
No, I think it's the majority don't ever make it out, or if they make it out, they make it out with scars that will always be in them. They might be able to walk around and act like nothing's wrong, but that doesn't mean they didn't go through a time where it was super bad. So it's always sad, but it's one of those things that's like, unfortunately, it's hard to just make entertainment that's only adults all the time. Gotta involve kids in some way to tell every story out there that you possibly can. And with that comes the collateral damage of ruining kids' lives.
And, you know, I think I may have told this story on the show years ago where, you know, our son was, when he was little, he, you know, had the blonde hair, you know, blue eyes. I mean, he looked adorable. He was offered a role in what became a very popular film. He was offered a role, and Carol looked at me, and apparently I had a look of horror on my face, because Carol would have gone with what I said because of my background. And I said, absolutely not. And I told her, and we're not even telling him about this at all. Yeah. I think we told him when he was an adult, because I think we were watching the film
on
TV.
Yeah, there is no amount of money that it would ever be worth it. And that's the hard part of it, is that a lot of these decisions are then the parents get their kids in because they're mildly interested, or the parents know that their kids have something special and put them in, and then it becomes about the parents and the money. And that's a bad, dark road to go down. So there's no amount of money anyone could offer to put my son in something. And there's no amount of begging he could, even if there was a guaranteed time machine that said everything's going to end up okay. I could never take that chance.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And you'd have to be there like every minute, every second.
Uh-huh.
You know, never, ever let him be by himself with anybody.
Yep. I want him to change the world in better ways, whether it's any other way.
So
just not acting.
So anyway, so you know, Bobby Driscoll should be remembered. I mean, you know, for he was a good actor. He was, you know, he was a gifted child actor at what he did, and an excellent voice actor. He was also the live action reference for Peter Pan. So he definitely had acting ability there.
Yeah.
So it's just a shame that, like we said, that he couldn't overcome that and live a fruitful adult life.
And I think Disney fans still appreciate him. And so many don't know of how it ended up with him. Don't even think about, like, I wonder if he made it out on the other side, like a Haley Mills. Like, mm-hmm. But ultimately, even if they do find out and they listen to this and find out, it doesn't take away from anything he did. I think the appreciation is still fully there for him. And that's what annoyed me a couple of years ago when they released the Chippendale Rescue Rangers movie on Disney Plus, and people were up in arms that, well, you can't portray Peter Pan being a washed up alcoholic type person, knowing what happened to Bobby Driscoll. And it's like, get over it. There was not an intention of making a statement about Bobby Driscoll's life after he was done being a child star when this movie was developed. It's one of those things, a random coincidence. The best thing to do is to not focus on that aspect of his life and just appreciate the things that he did that left such a meaningful impact on the Disney community.
Yep. Yeah. So, yeah, I didn't see that, but I do remember the controversy over it. So, anyway, but, you know, I'm talking about actors and all of that. We talked about the Disney Legends a while back. We just went through the experience of purchasing D23 Expo tickets. So, Craig, were you successful at getting tickets?
Yes, I was, thanks to a good friend, who's also a Patreon supporter. I was like many people out there. We had a lot of windows open and trying to hedge our bets to get the best place possible in the randomized queue. And I actually didn't have an awful place by the time my spot opened up and I looked at what tickets were left. Like, there was still tickets available at the price points that I was comfortable with, but thanks to a friend who got in a lot earlier, not in the little issue where they had to shut down sales for a little bit. He was after that, so no issues with getting tickets at all, but got us, you know, seats that we were so happy with and at the right price point that we felt comfortable with, and happy that I'm going to be inside the Honda Center for whatever we get to learn and find out. You know, I'd have a better view sitting at home watching it being live streamed. But ultimately, like, when people ask me why I want to be there, you know, in the past couple of years of the event, it was, well, I want to be as close to the stage as possible to see these celebrities with my eyes. Now that it's back to the $2,600 price point to be in that realm, that's not happening anymore. I'm not in that position where I can afford that, nor would I ever pay that again. Not without the benefits and perks that you used to get from the Sorcerer's Pass that made that amount of money worthwhile. But for me now, it's just, I want to see the footage for the very first time that they show in those panels, because even when they do live streams and stuff, they always stop the feeds right when it gets to the exclusive trailers or behind the scenes clips that you see. And a lot of times, you know, they'll release a trailer right after and you'll get to see it. But there's times where you don't get to see it again for a lot longer than when the first trailer is finally released. It's completely different from what you got to see before. A lot of times what they'll do at the expo is, like with the movies, they'll start off with like a 5-minute clip from the movie, and then that will go into a trailer. And so you'll get to see the trailer, but you won't get to see the clips before. And that's the stuff that, like, that always gets me so insanely hyped up for stuff. Like, I didn't love the Little Mermaid movie, but I will never forget being in the room, getting to watch the full sequence of getting to see Halle Bailey sing Part of Your World and as part of that live action remake. And I was like, that was incredible getting to see that. The movie as a whole wasn't, but being in the room to see that when everyone else only got like a 10-second clip in the trailer later on. It's like, I like having that first experience. Or, you know, when people are questioning, will Moana be good? I can remember sitting in that room and getting to see the first sequence with the young Moana interacting with the water. And it's like, whoa, this is going to be something else that people aren't ready for. That's why I go to Expo. So I wanted to be in the room and have as good of a view of the stage as possible and see the screens as well as I could and get in there. And I'm successful for it, but I only have so many years left on this earth. And if I have to go through that stress every single time, eventually it will become not worth it for me anymore. 'Cause I feel like I aged at least a year that day.
Oh, I know. It was so stressful. It shouldn't have to be. And then especially as in early on when we started to hear that people were getting in and then they into the queue, you know, after they waited in the queue, yeah, the little green man got in. And then there was no, the screen to purchase the tickets was blank.
Yeah. Unacceptable.
Or they were able to select the tickets, but then the purchase button was missing.
Yeah.
For us, what happened is, and I didn't get in, a friend did, because we were sort of a team and all that. And I had like three browsers open. On one, I logged in like at 7 a.m. just to see. That was the worst number of all of them. I think they punished me. It was like 35,000 and something. And then the person that got in logged in after all of us. And
that's hilarious.
Got in right away. I mean, got in fairly quickly. But then what happened with us was he selected merchandise, because like I wanted the pin, and then someone else wanted the bolo, the bolo lanyard thing.
He selected
the merchandise, but then when he went to check out, the merchandise wasn't in the cart. And you couldn't get the pop-up window to come back up again for the merchandise. So I don't know if that happened to anybody else. So I thought, you know, I got the ticket. If I don't get the little pin, it's not the end of the world, because I'm just going to throw it in a box.
Yeah. And they will have pins for sale at the expo.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, because I always like to get an event pin.
Yeah.
But I felt sorry for the people that they got in and then they got kicked out because they timed out, because there was no way to get the, you know, to purchase the tickets. And then they go back to the end of the queue.
Yeah.
And it was horrible. And it happened both days, day one and day two. We're recording on day three. And it's, in fact, it opened up 5 minutes ago. I have no idea if it's happening again.
Yeah. So, I mean, but at this point, it's only single day tickets are left.
And the $2,000 floor seats
are
available in the Honda Center.
But only for gold members. And gold members at this point, if they didn't get them on day one and they didn't get them on day two, I doubt they're going to all of a sudden find a random $2,600 plus taxes and processing fees or whatever it is. So I think that is the one travesty with all of this now. I know they didn't let that pricing structure sit too long before they actually revealed the real pricing on it, but they overshot themselves on that one. If if at max that front section would have been $1,500 and then like $1,300 and $1,200 or then $1,000 in the back, complete different game. It would be sold out now, but they took a big swing. And now I'm like, well, what the heck are you going to do? Are you going to like just leave empty open seats down front in the front area of the stage? Like just have that? Like that looks so tacky and so bad.
No, they'll sell them at a cheaper price, cheaper than what everyone else paid. That's what that's what they've done in the past. What really gets me is, you know, it was nice that they let people buy eight tickets because, like, you could sit with your family and friends. So it was good intentions. But with good intentions, there are people that exploit it because immediately there were the people that bought eight tickets and now they're reselling them.
Oh, yeah. And I didn't know that they were doing that many seats available. I thought, you know, in the past with when you were going for Sorcerers or for the last one when they did the preferred seating, you could only do two tickets. And I figured that was the limit for this one, too. And I'm like, okay, well, when I got my queue, I was like, I was 9,000 in line. And I'm like, okay, well.
Oh, that's what every I was. Single, I was 9,000.
Yeah, if every single person buys a ticket, then there's going to be sold out. Because I was like, two tickets, so that's 18, so it'll be sold out. I'm like, however, I know a lot of people were posting, I'm not dealing with the Honda Center, I only want regular tickets. Some people are only buying one ticket. Like, there's still a chance
and
we'll
then
get two.
People and then I saw like me, I had three browsers open, so.
Yeah.
You know,
so, yeah, exactly. Spots, yeah. There was, I'm sure, he had, like, the person that got us our tickets, he must have was rubbing shamrocks or lucky rabbit's feet or something, because he had, like, three of his browsers were all under 10,000. So
oh, that's
he just,
amazing.
Yeah, he got really lucky. But then it's like, then when I saw the number was you can buy up to eight tickets, I'm like, I don't even know if the first 2,000 to 3,000 people will be lucky enough. Because if someone figures this out, that all you need to do is have a D23 general membership, and then the person who bought the tickets can transfer the tickets to anyone, like people can flip. They can easily buy all eight tickets that they're allowed to get and then just flip them. But the hardest part would have been getting eight tickets in a row all together to be able to flip, because once they started going, it was gaps. And I mean, it's just, and as you selected, you might have them and then they're gone. Oh, it was madness.
It was crazy. The only good thing is, well, the one good thing is that I don't have to camp out on a floor because I am way too old for that.
Yeah. Reserve seats are very nice because even with the preferred seating the last time around, you know, we still had to get in our queue spot. And, you know, luckily I was with like Mary Jo and Luella. And so we were still waiting an hour to 90 minutes just for our preferred spots. So we were either in the second or third row and weren't like super far on the ends. So I very much prefer the fact that now they're doing this reserve seating, but it just the infrastructure was a complete disaster. I think even the way they're doing this is a disaster, having the Honda Center be set up for like a concert. I know that makes the most sense because you want the celebrities have to as short a walk as possible, come out from behind a screen, do the wave thing, and then go back in. But they could have filled so many more seats and really gave everyone a better view if they would have done a center stage and then left the giant jumbo scoreboard screen in its place up above. And then you could see the screen from all four sides. If you were anywhere around the bowl, the only place you wouldn't be able to see it is if you bought the floor seats, but they could have set up small TVs or something somewhere around to showcase it in other spaces. But it just like, I don't know, this one, it feels like they might have gone too far with this. Like, yeah, they need more room than Hall D23 has to offer, but I'm not sure if this was the next best step, especially with the price point. But I know once we're in the room, I'm gonna forget all that and be like, this was such a great idea, I'm so happy we got this. But I hate so many people missed out on it. It's because there's not another chance. It's not like, oh, you know, you did have multiple chances to get the seats, but once they're sold out, they're gone. It's just this weekend. You don't have another chance until 2 years from now when it's all over again. It's not like even with a concert, like you didn't get them in the city you were going for. Okay, well, you know what? maybe try a different city that's close by and have a chance. It's just the stakes are a lot more different, and I feel bad for people who missed out. It's one of those things. I think every Disney fan should get a chance to experience it at least once in person. And
yeah,
it kills me that so many people are just left with such a bitter taste in their mouth because it's just not done well.
Yeah, I don't understand why they have so many problems with it. So
yeah. And you know, the other option, if they wanted to cause less issues, opposite to what I said, they should have got real aggressive with that pricing. And if the cheapest ticket you could have got to sit in that arena for all three nights of the big events was $1,000, the queue would not have been an issue, because a lot less people would be willing to pay that much to just have reserve seating, but they still would have been out there.
Yeah. But then you alienate fans who say, you know, they're price gouging. This is to pay for Bob Iger's private jet. I mean, you know, it'll be everything. I had joked, friends, you know, we all expected this to go badly so Bob Iger can report to the board and the shareholders that they met all expectations on selling the tickets, because it went badly.
Yeah, honestly, so. I'm not opposed to them price gouging. If it's one of those things, when this is such a limited event and it's, like I said, that one weekend only, I feel like, you know what? It's one of those things that it's not a right as a Disney fan that you get to be there. It's one of those things where, like, either make the membership more expensive so that way it limits how many people sign up for the gold membership to get into the head, or make that so insanely expensive. Like, if you care enough, you'll pay for it. And if you don't, then you won't go. The fact that now they had the convention only side, if that's what you care most about it, and the smaller panels that are there, then perfect. They're still giving you something for a really great price point.
There's a couple good small panels. I forget the two that they promoted. One was on the 1963-64 World's Fair. So, you know, I'm interested in that one.
Yeah.
Or 64-65 World's Fair. There was another one that was really good, and it was a history-related one, and I can't recall in the video I was watching from the Grand Central Terminal, Air Terminal.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of great stuff. And for once, now that you know the big event is at night, and that's what you are – you know, you're doing anything you want during the day. At night, you have your reserved seat. It allows you to actually enjoy the panels and stuff, unlike what it's been for the past couple of years. And I love, love, love that they're handling it like that for that specific reason. I don't know. Maybe they weren't aggressive enough with the price point. Like, the more I think about it, the fact that for only $100 more, you could do all three nights of reserve seating at the highest level inside the Honda Center. Maybe that wasn't enough of a gap, even if all the prices were doubled, and or there was only Honda Center only tickets, and then if you wanted the convention, you had to also buy that too, right? Maybe that's how they should have done it. Just because, you know, they gotta feel like they gotta do something to really try to curb out. You're only gaining more fans, and every time around they see this event happen and hear the feedback of how cool it is and how you have to go there and you have to see it and experience it, you're only getting more people that want to show up. So the issue is only going to continue getting worse. And I don't want the next answer to be, okay, well, we're going to host it in Anaheim, but then we're going to have to make you travel all the way to the Sophie Stadium in downtown Los Angeles so we can sit in a football stadium that holds 80,000 people.
That might get me to buy the convention only ticket, because the traffic would be so horrendous.
The
next two disasters that are going to happen, of course, there's going to be the reservation system for shopping and all that. So that's going to go horribly awry. And then the shuttle system from the convention center to the Honda Center.
Hey, I will help them out here. And I'll give them advice up front now. I know they're going to ignore it. They're not going to hear it at all. But stop wasting time with the Disney store when it's just stuff from Shop Disney and very little exclusives to put in the store. Stop overproducing stuff for the expo that people aren't really buying. Everyone just wants Mickey's of Glendale. Overproduce merchandise to sell for Mickey's of Glendale. Make every store include stuff from Mickey's of Glendale. It'll be a lot easier then.
Do you think Disney would be able to go after the people that bought tickets only to sell them in the aftermarket or whatever it's called and like cancel those tickets and make them available to people that really want to go to this event?
No. As far as I read from the terms and conditions, there was nothing I read that said like tickets can't be transferred, tickets can't be sold. And maybe that was in it and I just didn't do a good job of reading, but everything that I read with it said like you can't cancel your tickets, there's no refunds for it, tickets can't be transferred to anyone who has a D23 membership, whether it's gold or general, and that's all I saw. So there was nothing that said like, you know, because technically anyone like you were in that position too, where you had a friend purchase. I had a friend purchase. If they put rules on that, technically they could go after them saying, well, you resold it. It's like we're friends, but yeah, anyone can be friends. So I think it's just the reality that if they do it that way, that going to get people to do it. It's going to help some people out, and hopefully no one buys and sinks in until like the day before the convention. So that way at that point, the resellers are just happy to get their money back for it. Cause they're still in the profit phase right now where they're going to want more because
they're going for hot, ridiculous prices right now from the couple sites I saw.
If people don't buy it, it will drop back down. It's the same thing that happens with some concert tickets. Not as much anymore now that we live in a day and age where Ticketmaster does the stupid pricing, whereas the concert fills up, the prices get insanely more expensive. Some of the best seats I've ever bought or last minute concert tickets, I'm usually getting at a fair value or less, especially when it's people reselling. It's an hour before the concert when they realize, well, we're not going to it and no one bought our tickets. They will sell it at anything just to get their money. So there was one time I bought Broadway tickets, not for Broadway, but Broadway in Orlando, where I got the best seats I've ever sat in that theater. I got them 2 hours before the show for half the price because the people just wanted them gone that badly. So, and didn't want to give them to friends. It's just, you never know. So, that would be my advice to people out there. If you didn't get your tickets yet, don't go straight to the resellers. Have faith and hope. And then sometimes you never know when people's travel arrangements change and good people out there can't go as it gets closer to the event and say, you know, I just want to get what I paid out of them. They'll be out there. So patience.
Yeah. Well, I might drive down with my van and maybe, you know, I'll pick up a couple extra bucks by charging people to go to the Honda Center and back.
That's the best idea you could come up with. You know, just don't get stuck in like an Uber thing where it's like, okay, can you take me back to my hotel? I'm staying at the Lowe's Hollywood Hotel right now.
Oh no, it'll have to be back to the Hilton where I'm staying. Anyway, well, I'm sure we'll continue reporting this. We hope we see you there at D23 Expo, and I'll be at the parks a few days after that because I'll be celebrating my birthday. So if you're there too, we can celebrate together. So just quickly, I wanted to get your thoughts on it. Craig, you probably already know mine. Hong Kong Disneyland, which I think is a very underrated park. I love that park. It is getting a Marvel overlay. It's temporary. It's a Small World, where it's like, it looks like it's baby versions. It reminds me of Baby Muppets, but I guess it's just like, they look like little doll versions, I guess, of the Marvel characters featuring Groot. So what do you think of this? Because this is really outside the scope of a traditional It's a Small World.
I'm okay with it. It's one of those things where I feel like at this point in time with It's a Small World, the only one that I believe is like you can't touch it more than it's already been touched is Disneyland's version. And, you know, I know there was controversy when they first added the movie characters in, but this feels like it's on a different level.
It is.
I mean, I guess we don't know until it's all placed in there, but obviously it's Marvel takes place in our world, but a very fictionalized version of it. So it's not like, you know, it's harder. How do you get an Ant-Man in there? Like, where do you put him in? The movie takes place in San Francisco, but the United States is not really a big portion of It's a Small World. So there's a lot of questions with stuff like that. How do you make it work in that way? But overall, like, I've said it many times on recent episodes of our Walt Disney World show. I don't care if our Walt Disney World version of the attraction goes away completely. I like Paris's, but if they Paris's wanted to do nice. Something to that, then go ahead and do it. And with Disneyland's, you added the characters in, you don't have to go any crazier. You can add more characters if it warrants it as new movies come out. You know, if you want to throw Moana in to fit in with the South Pacific sections, go ahead and do that. But like, that's the only one that I'm like, don't go crazy with. Outside of that, if they want to try different things, why the heck not? It may be, maybe the next great attraction comes because they experiment with a limited time overlay to something like this.
Yeah, maybe. That's the only positive thing I can see out of this. But I don't know. I feel like it's crossing over into something dangerous. Then it's going to be Star Wars. Then it's going to be who knows what else. And I don't know. I think it's just outside the scope of what it was meant to be and all that. But so I'm glad they're doing it in an international park. So we can sort of see what it looks like, but I have no doubt it'll make it into a United States park at some point. So it would be interesting to do it at Walt Disney World because they really haven't updated that attraction in a long time.
Yeah,
so, and I mean, how it's accepted there.
I'd be interested in it, and so from what I understand, I'm not an expert in it since I haven't traveled internationally. I guess the version of It's a Small World that it's being added to was already designed with like Joey Chow's artwork. So he's the one who has that cutesy look to it. And I guess that It's a Small World is already designed with that look versus the Mary Blair style. So I think it has the potential to fit in a little bit more. It's not necessarily the, okay, we have this very specific style that we have to stick to that dates back to the 60s that we need to fit it in. It's an artist that's still creating work for Disney that was used to inspire. And then I feel like it can fit in a little bit better in that way. But again, I'm not an expert. It's just the little bit that I looked into it. Yeah. As far as I care with it, I saw it. I'm like, cool. Something else I'll never get to see with Disney because it'll be gone before I'd even have the opportunity. Yeah. So I hope the video that someone does looks good.
So anyway, it'll be interesting. So looking forward to seeing the photos, and I'm sure somebody will take a video of it and post it on YouTube.
For sure.
Anyway, and well, this weekend is Easter. So we want to wish everybody who's celebrating a very happy and blessed Easter. What will Rory be doing come Easter morning?
Hopefully sleeping in since it's a Sunday, but I'm sure he'll be awake and we'll be like, hey, do you want your Easter basket? And he'll say Elmo. And then that will be our next burden for a while.
So does he have a Tickle Me Elmo? Do they still make those?
I don't think they make them. No, he doesn't even. We bought him a little plush Elmo because he loves watching Elmo, and it doesn't matter to him. He just wants to watch the same four Elmo videos over and over again. It's wonderful.
So what? I know. Wait till he gets into Disney films and wants to watch the same one over again 100 times.
So, I'm okay with that because at least those have length to them. I'm so over videos that are only 2 minutes to 7 minutes long.
I'll teach him. This is the rewind button, son. What is in his Easter basket, since I'm sure candy isn't a big part of what the bunny's bringing?
We bought him a little Duplo building set, because he's just about there. That he'll want to put those together, and then I think that's all we got. His basket's a little bit big because it's the same one that I had from when I was a kid, and I feel like stuff was just built a little bit better back then. Mm-hmm. and nicer, but not much more room for anything in there besides that. I think we bought him like two little small books to put in there, and that's it. So,
oh, that's cute. When I got my Snow White Lego set, it came with two free gifts, and they were both Easter themed.
So. Yeah, I missed out on that. I bought my Snow White set before those were gifts that you could get. And then I went to buy another set, and the one that you got, if it was like over $100, was already gone at that point. It was just like the cheaper one that comes in the small bag was still available, it's a shame, because I actually like those little, when they give them out seasonally. My Easter bonus from last year is actually sitting out on our TV stand this year. It was just like, it looks like a little flower pot, and it's like a little bunny that's just poking his head out of it. And it's so cute. So I like when they do those little special sets.
I almost bought a Lego set that I saw at Costco, and it's all flowers. And I thought, this is adorable.
They're doing those a lot now. Like, it started with like full blown sets where it was like, looked like flowers and pots. Cause I almost got the Birds of Paradise one for my tiki stuff, and have it be in there and feel kind of like tiki room-ish. But they've gotten now to the point where they do like individual flowers, which I'm like, that's brilliant for people that like building Lego and, you know, might work in a place where they can't water flowers all the time, won't survive because it's dark. Just get a little pot and get a couple of the little Lego flowers and put them in a pot, and yeah, flowers that never die.
Yeah. Yeah. A little different than plastic flowers.
Yeah.
So, well, I used several references when working on this episode. And for books, I used Walt Disney's Fantasia by John Culhane, the Taschen book, The Walt Disney Film Archives, the animated movies, 1921 to 1968. I'd say who it was edited by, but if you thought I had a problem with the composer's name, A Night on Bald Mountain, there's no hope for my pronouncing the last name of Daniel, who edited the Walt Disney Film Archives book, but did a magnificent job. Walt Disney's Fantasia by Deems Taylor, hit the book that he put out back in the day, and the original Fantasia program. Some websites and articles I used: The Making of Fantasia, Disney's Masterpiece by the Houston Symphony, the Disney Wiki on Fantasia, Walt Disney's Fantasia, justdisney.com, The Sorcerer's Apprentice, The Genesis of Fantasia by Jay Gabler for Your Classical, 15 Fascinating Facts About Fantasia, d23.com, Fantasia, Walt Disney's Pioneering Classic by Jamie Atkins, The Untold Truth of Disney's Fantasia by Sarah Buttery. Craig will include these links to the resources in our episode description. So, Craig, until next time, how can our listeners connect with you?
You can find me on all the different Diz Unlimited shows I'm on. You can follow me on social media at Teleclaster, and you can email me, craig@disneyinfo.com. What about you, Michael?
You can send me messages at michaelbowling@disneyinfo.com. Maybe I'll make up a name for Twitter. Maybe Twittix. About that. We talked about making up words. We can call it Twittix. Yeah. At M Bowling. What? Yeah.
I like it.
Oh, thank you. At mbowling121. Facebook, I'm Michael Bowling, connecting with Walt. Instagram, Michael Bowling the Diz. And you can connect with me and Craig on Twitter or Twittix at Connecting Walt. If you'd like to listen to more shows on the history of Walt Disney, his studio, his Imagineers, and Disneyland, check out our Disneyland podcast archives for my Disney history episodes. On the link Craig includes in our episode description, look for past episodes of Connecting with Walt on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, Pandora, and Amazon podcasts, where you can subscribe to our show and leave some positive reviews and ratings when possible. So thank you for making us a part of your day. And remember, I only hope that we don't lose sight of one thing, that it was all started by a man, Walt Disney, and his brother, Roy.